And first of all, I want to thank the committee staff, my committee staff, and all the committee staff for helping make this possible. It is a little bit of a logistic challenge when we leave the Capitol to set up, as you can see, the microphones and everything that we need. And I want to thank OSU, Oregon State University, for hosting us, and obviously for everybody coming today. And I apologize again about the small room. And we're going to simulate climate change right in this room today as the temperature gets up a little bit. So that was part of the plan. I would first like to thank some of my colleagues who are here who are not on the committee, and I think we're going to start out by going around the dais and having everyone introduce themselves so you all know who we are. And I'll start by saying I'm Representative Jackie Dingfelder. I represent a district in Northeast Portland, serving my fourth term in the Oregon Legislature, and I chair this committee. Very excited to have some guests here today, and I think we'll start over here with Representative Vince.
I'm Representative Vince from District 60, serving my fifth week, or maybe it's my sixth week in the legislature, and happy to be here.
And District 60, for folks who don't have numbers memorized, includes?
It's Harney County, Mount Hair County, Baker County, and half of Grant County.
These are about half the state. Thanks for coming a long way today to join us.
I am Sarah Gelser, and I represent the best district in the entire state. District 16, which is right here in Corvallis and Philomath, and includes Oregon State University, and also serve on the Revenue Committee discussions.
I'm Representative Bill Garrard from Klamath Falls and Klamath County.
And serve on this committee.
And District 56, and I serve on the committee. I'm an authentic member.
Get a passport.
I'm Ben Cannon. I represent District 46, which is in East Portland. Also a member of the committee.
You can judge Petrino on the committee administrator.
And I'm Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and with all due respect to my esteemed colleague, Representative Gelser, I represent the best district in the state of Oregon, the city of Bend, where many of you probably come to vacation on time.
Representative Terry Beyer, and I represent the city of Springfield, and I am proud to serve on, have served on this committee with Taskmaster.
Is that a hint?
And I'm a Representative Paul Holby. I'm from Eugene, represent the University of Oregon, South Eugene, Downtown Eugene, Lorain, Bonita, and some other points in the rural areas. And I'm not a member of this committee, just a guest. Thank you for having me.
For being here.
I'm State Senator Floyd Brzezinski, representing District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas County and a small sliver of Coulee. I sit on the Senate Environment Natural Resources, and thank you again for inviting me to be a part of it. And I also have within that district, which Paul represents, documents. Thank you.
And Representative Barnhart was here.
Straighten his tie.
Okay, so he'll be back, and I think he'll be joining us up at the dais. So appreciate everybody coming today, and especially folks who don't serve on the committee but are interested in hearing about the issue that we're going to talk about today, and climate change, addressing climate change. And as many of you know, the bill, the Oregon Climate Change Innovation Act, went through our committee last session. It passed overwhelmingly in the House and Senate in 2007. And so today we're going to hear from folks who are going to come testify, primarily providing updates on science of climate change. And we're going to hear from a lot of OSU scientists, which is very exciting, and learn about the impacts, latest updates on the impacts on our water supplies, on forest resources, on agricultural resources, and also hear about the impacts of public health. And then we are fortunate to have also the chair of the Transportation Commission here today. He's also going to talk about transportation issues related to climate change. And then we are going to have an update on the phone from David Vantoff out of the governor's office. He's actually in Portland. I don't know if the meeting finished, but there was a big meeting on the Western Climate Change Initiative today, and so he's going to be here via phone. And then we're going to have sort of a wrap-up with Mark Abbott, who is the Dean of the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences, and he's also the Vice Chair of the Global Warming Commission. We will have some time at the end for public comment. So we're going to have a little bit of a packed agenda. I'm going to ask the folks who come up if they can limit their comments to about, let's say, 8 minutes, and then we can leave time for questions as well. So with that, I'd like to introduce Jeff Shannon. Did I say that right?
You did.
And he's with Oregon State University. Thanks for being here. And
sure.
You can provide a little bit of introduction. That would be...
This window is locked. Hold on one moment, please. We have some technical difficulties. Anyone know the password on here?
We'll get the... Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
I'm at Oregon State University. I'm in the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences. I am a climate scientist and atmospheric scientist, and I've been asked to come up and give a little bit of background on the IPCC and the state of climate science.
And the IPCC, for those folks who aren't familiar with the acronym.
So I have the enviable task of doing this in 8 minutes, or is it really... Can I go a little over?
You've got I think because you're the lead-off speaker, you've got a few more minutes that you can panel, though, since we have about six panelists. We'll have to limit that.
Okay. So, this is a pointer. So, the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and the role of the IPCC is to assess on a comprehensive and objective, open and transparent basis the scientific, technical, and socioeconomic information relative to understanding climate change, its potential impacts, options for adaptation and mitigation. I'm reading this verbatim. This is right off their website. It's sponsored in part by the World Meteorological Organization, elements of the UN. It's important to note that this panel, which has 120 member countries and entrained scientists and government officials from these countries, does not carry out research itself. What it does is it does not monitor climate-related data itself. Basically, its job or its mandate is to assess the peer-reviewed literature at the time and to come up with a consensus on what that states. Because it is such a large body, and the organization publishes what's known as a consensus document, which by its nature is conservative, because it means that everybody signing it, has to agree to every word on it. As a result, you tend to get statements in it that are not going to be the extremes in the positions either way. They're not going to overstate or understate it, because if they did so, they're going to actually just get locked up in gridlock. Basically, we won't be able to publish it. So everybody actually has to agree to every word on it. As a result, it's sort of a middle-of-the-road document on the state climate change as it's seen. There's some issues of terminology in it, and these documents are available. They're available on the website. If you go to ipcc.ch, you can download all the documents. There are three assessments. The first one deals with the physical basis of the climate change. Climate change, and the way they refer to it, is any change in climate over time, whether due to natural or anthropogenic activities. They also have some other terms, and there's one term that I'm going to put up here because it's important for a graphic that we're going to look at momentarily, and that's radiative forcing. And what that is, it's a measure of the influence that some factor, be it CO2, be it methane, be it land use, be it solar variability, has on altering the balance of incoming and outgoing energy in the Earth atmosphere system, the whole climate system. And so whether or not a factor is important for pushing or controlling climate change depends on how much radiative forcing that factor has. Positive forcing means it's going to warm surface temperatures. Negative forcing means that it's going to tend to cool temperatures. The radiative values are all for 2005, and they're all calculated relative to pre-industrial conditions. So, if we look at some of the trends that have taken place right now, let's just look at some of the observations of some of the climate change factors. In this case, greenhouse gases is the big one we're looking at. This plot, I have a pen here. Does anyone have a pointer? Is this a okay. Pen, and I can write, and I can point. So right here, what we have are CO2 on the top, methane in the middle, and nitrous oxide on the bottom. What it shows you is the progression of this over the last 10,000 years. It's reconstructed from ice core data, other sedimentary data, but primarily ice core data. And what you see is the parts per million concentration right here of carbon dioxide over the last 10,000 years. It goes along, there's a slight climb taking place, but when you get to the modern era in 1750, it shoots way up. Okay? So what we see in all three of these gases is the contribution from human activity, burning of fossil fuels, primarily also agricultural land use practices. So what's going on with some of the individuals? LIP ones. This is carbon dioxide shown in a little greater detail right here. And you can see that the global average concentration of CO2 has increased from a pre-industrial level of about 280 parts per million to where we are right now in 2005, at least, of 379. We're about 383 now, I believe. The atmospheric concentration in 2005, as reported in this, exceeds by far the natural rain that was observed over the previous 650,000 years from paleo reconstructions from ice core data, which varied between 180 to 300 parts per million. So we're far outside that envelope right now. The primary source of this, and this is all this data and all this information I'm giving you, this is not mine. This is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I'm just really repeating this, and some of it verbatim. The primary source is attributed to pre-industrial, is the result of fossil fuel use. Land use is another contributor, but it's smaller, but it's a significant contributor to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You can look at another one of them, just methane. We could go through all of them if you want, but we'll just look at methane. It has a similar trend. You can see it went from 715 parts per billion, that's what the PPB stands for pre-industrial times, over double that. Now it's at 1775 in 2005. And that exceeds, again, by far, the natural range that was observed in the ice core data prior to the Industrial Revolution, going back over the last 650,000 years. They state that it is very likely, and they have a number of buzzwords, very likely, likely, extremely likely, not likely, and they all have probabilities that they associate in their consensus with that. So they think there's a greater than 90% likelihood that the observed increase in methane is due to anthropogenic activities and predominantly agriculture and fossil fuel use. So here's this chart that they've published that is about the radiative forcing components right here, okay? And what they say is basically since the last report, which was in 2001, they've had come to an improved understanding of the climate system, and they have very high confidence, which is defined as a 90% chance of being correct, that the globally average net effect of human activity since 1750 has been one of warming, and this is the amount of radiative forcing, about plus 1.6 watts per meter squared, with some error bars around it. If you look above that, you can see the various contributions to that. And you can see that a big contribution to that right there is CO2, and then here's methane, there's nitrous oxide, there are halocarbons there, other ones. The carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, which I showed in that first plot, are big players in this. They're 2.3. In fact, they're in excess of the total that you see right there. Okay? And it's unprecedented. This rate of increase that we see during the industrial era is unprecedented in more than 10,000 years. We haven't seen anything like this before. We're really perturbing the system in a way and at a speed which has not been previously documented in the Earth's record. Another big factor are anthropogenic aerosols. And these things are like sulfates, organic carbons, black carbon, nitrate, dust. These result in cooling effects. Some of them are what are known as direct effects, and that they directly scatter sunlight. Another provide cloud albedo or indirect effects, in that they alter the composition or the structure of cloud and the properties, their radiative properties, and how, whether or not they're cooling or heating the planet. And what you can see is that there's a large uncertainty on this. We understand it better than we did in 2001 at the time, but if you look over here, this is the level of scientific understanding. It's still fairly low. And this is the dominant uncertainty in our understanding of the climate system right now. There are other contributors to it, things like tropospheric ozone, halocarbons, changes to surface albedo due to land use or black carbon. They also have on here some natural forcing due to solar irradiance, changes in solar variability, and you can see it's actually just a nominal player right there. It's estimated to be a very small amount of this total radiative forcing. So much of the radiative forcing changes that we've seen since 1750 are really due to what we've been doing up here, these anthropogenic effects. That's what the chart breaks down to. So another thing that they do is they actually attribute climate change, which is something that they haven't done before. A lot of it's been mostly observed, but what they're talking about now is here that the cause of it, and they think it's very likely, again that means this greater than 90% probability, that the temperature changes, the globally averaged increase in temperature since the mid-20th century, is due to the observed increase in anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations. And that has had discernible effects on aspects of the climate, including oceanic warming, continental average temperatures, extreme temperatures, wind patterns. So this is a demonstration of what it's talking about. Unfortunately, the colors aren't so good right here. That's not good coming off the projector. What this is it shows different components of the climate system. It breaks it down. This is North America. The top six plots are for each of the six continents shown there. This is the globally average temperature anomalies over the last over the 20th century, global land and global ocean. The black line is the observations, and the blue window, which is this lower one here, which is a little difficult to discern, it's blue. This is an ensemble of models. These are global climate models that have all the physics of the climate system as we best understand it now, and are trying to reproduce that 20th century temperature record. And the envelope is basically multiple runs from multiple different models, and it shows you the spread of them. If you just put in natural forcing, that's that blue smear that you see in all of them. And what it does is it fails to capture the warming that's taken place since 1950. It's only if you put in the anthropogenic changes, which include land use, include greenhouse gases, include sulfates and black carbon and all that stuff, you get this actual rising that you see in all of them. So these models are highly indicative that you really can't explain what's going on without putting in this anthropogenic forcing, and that the warming that we've seen over the last 50 years is the result of them. Here are some observations that they published in the IPCC showing the state of warming that's taken place. This is from about 1850 onward. Shows you global mean temperatures rising, shows you globally average sea level rising, and it shows you a decrease in the northern hemisphere snow cover, all which are consistent for the warming of the planet on a global basis. Sea level rise is one of the things I just mentioned there. Mountain glaciers and snow cover have declined on average in both hemispheres. There's widespread decrease in glaciers and ice caps. Greenland and Antarctica are very likely to have contributed to sea level rise over the last 10 years. And this gives you a figure of how much it's risen. This is a publication showing you the change in alpine glaciers since 1970. And these are the ones that have thinned over here in yellow and red. And the larger they are, the more they've thinned, and you can see for the alpine glaciers, almost all of them are thinning at this point. There are some areas, like for instance right here in Norway, where they're expanding, but on a global basis, you're really seeing a loss of alpine glaciers. For the Arctic, the average Arctic temperatures increased at almost twice the global average rate in the past 100 years. Arctic temperatures have a high decadal variability, and there was a warm period that's often talked about between 1925 and 1945, but there's also a rising trend. The annual average ice extent, the sea ice extent over the Arctic Ocean, has shrunk 2.7% per decade. Here's an observation showing the extent in September 1979. This is sort of the smallest portion. This is the state of the ice pack when it would be at its smallest, the end of boreal summer right here. And here's what it looked like in 2003. You can see there's a large reduction in the extent of sea ice. Hydrologic changes are also expected. They're expected and anticipated just from first principles that you would have more intense and longer droughts observed, sort of an intensification of the hydrologic cycle. Increased drying will be linked with higher temperatures, and there will be decreased precipitation totals. However, the way the precipitation is delivered will change also, so that you would have more heavy precipitation events, more heavy rain events, and less light or drizzle of the like that we're used to here, perhaps. Here are projections for the future, and these are based on climate models again. And it shows that for the next two decades is a warming of about 0.2 degrees Celsius. This is Celsius, not Fahrenheit, so that's equivalent to about 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. And that's projected for all emission scenarios. These lines and this spread show for different emission scenarios. As you go into the future, you have to assume that human beings are engaging in a certain amount of economic activity with certain consequences. We'll release a certain amount of CO2 and methane into the atmosphere. We don't know what that will be, so they run different scenarios. So what we can see is that the continued emission of greenhouse gases at or above current rates is going to cause further warming of the planet, between about 2 and 4 degrees right here. And it's very likely, they say, the IPCC, that it'll be larger changes than those observed during the 20th century. Here's just a synopsis of some of those scenarios right here, showing you some of the different ones. So here's the A. Again, we can't really see the colors, unfortunately, on the wall. The A2 is, believe it or not, that's red, and that is the high line right there. So that's the extreme scenario that's plotted, where you go up to about 1,250 parts per million by the end of the century. And then there are lower scenarios here. The less CO2 equivalents you put into the atmosphere, the less the planet will warm. Here's another look of it, instead of looking just at the global mean, it shows you a little bit of the distribution of temperatures. And what you would see, if this were actually clear in the colors on the wall, is that the Arctic is warming a lot faster in all the scenarios. The bottom scenario is the most CO2 intensive, and it has the greatest warming globally, and also incredibly intense warmings up in the Arctic at the high latitudes. Snow cover is projected to contract, widespread permafrost thaw is expected to occur, and sea ice is expected to shrink in both the Arctic and Antarctic. So an example of this would be, here's a projection from one study, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, and they projected what would happen to the sea ice over the Arctic again, just to show you again, you can see 2020, 2050, and 2080, a large decrease in the extent of ice. One last thing here is the future projection of the hydrologic cycle. For this, there's less certainty. It's less easy to pin this down, how exactly the hydrologic cycle will respond, but they do have plots of what model projections say for both the winter season right here and the summer season right here globally. It shows you a distribution. If you were to look at Oregon right here, it appears we're going to get possibly slightly wetter in the winter and possibly slightly drier in the summer. So, with all the set feedbacks and complexities of the climate system, one of the basic questions they want to ask is what happens to the global average surface temperatures following a doubling of CO2? And what they were is they issued for the first time a statement about what that would be quantitatively. They said likely, again, they're couching everything in probabilities, they would say greater than the two-thirds probability that it'll be somewhere between 2 and 4.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature, with the best estimate of about 3 degrees Celsius, okay? And it's very unlikely to be less than a degree and a half. Again, these are degrees Celsius here, so you roughly have to double them to get them to Fahrenheit to get a sense of what's going on. One last thing here is these are the observations for the Pacific Northwest. I'm sure some of the people following up are going to talk about it. Here are the temperature trends from 1920 to 2000 at stations in the Pacific Northwest, and here are the precipitation trends. So I will leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Talman. I think that's the most succinct presentation of the IPCC report I've ever heard. So with that, before we hear about specifics for the Pacific Northwest, to see if there's any questions about the report or any of the findings. Yeah, Representative Barnhart, who, by the way, we introduced everybody. You were out of the room, but Representative Barnhart is from, represents the Eugene area. You want to just say something before you ask your question?
Okay, thank you. I represent House District 11, which includes pieces of Eugene and then several of the smaller towns up into Linn County. I'm also the chair of the Revenue Committee, which, of course, is deeply involved with these issues, as we've learned over time. The specific question that I had was, how far back do we actually have reasonably reliable estimates of CO2 in the atmosphere and the effects of that on the weather? And I guess you've gotten back two-thirds of a million years. We have some ability to estimate a variety of things much farther back than that, with using other than ice core samples. Obviously, ice core doesn't go back much further. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is not my strongest area of expertise, okay. But let me answer what I do know. So for the instrumental record, for instance, there's a famous observatory record on the top of Hawaiian Island Mountain that shows in the free troposphere what CO2 has done over about roughly the last 50, 60 years. So that's an instrumental record that we have that's very good. It's a good measure of global CO2 concentrations, at least northern hemisphere CO2 concentrations. When you want to go back further than that, you have to start looking into other proxy records very often, and that's what you're referring to. So for instance, in ice core records, they literally pull air bubbles trapped out of it. So within the ice, there are air bubbles trapped. They can take that and they can measure the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and it's representative of how much CO2 was actually in the air at the time that the snow fell. And that can take you back about 650,000 years. There are ways of reconstructing CO2 much, much further back, and they show the reliability of which I'm really not an expert in.
Okay.
But these go back tens of millions of years, if not longer, perhaps. And they show that the planet had much, much larger CO2 concentrations potentially at different times when the planet was radically warmer, let's say in the Jurassic era or something along those lines. So how that all matches up, again, this is really beyond my area of expertise. I stick in the modern era.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Gurley.
Yeah, thank you. And somewhat along those lines, I guess, Jeff, one of the, you know, as I listen to this, and it's not the first time I've seen this presentation, Dr. Nielsen, I've seen it now with you a couple times here in the last few weeks. But one of the things that, you know, I keep looking for, and I think Representative Barnhart was kind of hinting at this, is really what's the baseline? What do we have to work from? I mean, you have, you know, in your presentation alone, you talked about 650,000 years, perhaps others millions since 1750. You said unprecedented in the past 10,000 years, but then we've got data from the mid-20th century, charts from 1850 on, glacier changes from 1970 on, sea levels from 1993 on, and it just seems to me like it'd be helpful if we had a little better baseline here on what we're really looking at. It seems like this is just a potpourri of different data sets that we're putting together.
Well, I would answer this two ways. Firstly, just to address the issue of the baseline. The baseline would be, let's say, over the last 650,000 years from the ice core reconstructions. And for that, CO2 varies between 180 and 300 parts per million as the ice ages vary, okay, which is as the temperatures of the globe varied through those ice ages. And we haven't seen anything within that period that's gone up to 380, which is where we are. So there is this variability that takes place over very long time scales. But if you want to get into the modern record over the last 10,000 years, things have been relatively constant. They haven't moved a lot around over the last 10,000 years, this period that's known as the Holocene. And in that period, it's been basically about 280 parts per million, and it stayed around that level the entire time until you hit the Industrial Revolution. And it's at that point when man started burning coal that you see this increase in CO2 taking place. Now, if your question also speaks to sort of the causality of it all and what's this have to do, if you want to get into the causality of why CO2 is important, it's really very basic first principle physics. I mean, the derivation of why CO2 is a greenhouse gas and why it's important for the Earth's radiative balance just falls right out of the first law of thermodynamics, Planck's law, Wien's law, etc. I could give you a 20-minute presentation on it, and it's basically old physics that goes back 400 years and is fairly immutable at this point. So it's very easy to see from first principles why the CO2 would be doing it. And it's fairly easy to see that when what's happened over the last 250 years since the Industrial Revolution. It's outside the envelope of what we've seen. It's outside the envelope of what we see even within the Ice Age variability, which we know there's been variability. So you're absolutely right when you say there's a lot of different baselines that you can look at and how, which one do I tease this apart from. I think if you're going to look at it, you want to look at the most immediate baseline that we have, which is the last 10,000 years when it was fairly flat and the climate system happened to be fairly conducive for the development of civilization and for people to go about their business and build societies. It's been fairly hospitable for people over the last 10,000 years. It's been fairly constant. And it's only in the last 250 years that things really have started to change as we've really built up our industrial complex.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Cannon.
Thanks for the presentation. Could you say just a few words about how we should make sense of years or days or places that are anomalies with respect to this sort of long-term trend of warming? For instance, this Oregon winter we've had with far above average snowpack. How do we make sense of that?
Well, there are two things. There's a difference between weather and climate. If you were to sit in on my undergraduate class, you would look at me.
We're also looking forward to having taken physics in college, I'm looking forward to the remedial course for legislators, frankly. That'll be next on the agenda.
So there's a difference between weather and climate. So, you know, I get on an airplane and somebody finds out I study the climate system, and of course it's a political topic as we're, well, you are all politicians, you know. So, some of them will sit down and say to me, you know, it was the hottest summer we ever had, oh, global warming is terrible, and the other, some of them will say, we had the Well, there are two things. There's a difference between weather and climate. If you were to sit in on my undergraduate class.
We're also looking forward to the, having taken physics in college, I'm looking forward to the remedial course for legislators, frankly. That'll be next on the agenda.
So the difference, there's a difference between weather and climate. So, you know, I get on an airplane and somebody finds out I study the climate system, and of course it's a political topic as well. Well, you are all politicians, you know. some of them will sit down and say to me, you know, it was the hottest summer we ever had. Oh, global warming is terrible. And the other, someone will say, we had the coldest winter I've ever seen. The global warming is not hot. Neither of those is evidence for or against. What those are is single data point. The climate is the statistics of weather, and it's very difficult for us as individuals to really observe it. I mean, you need to observe it for a very long period of time. You can observe the climate in one place by just looking at what's happened in a particular location. But to really get a sense of what's going on, you need to see the statistics over time. And you and I can't just perceive that. That's not intuitive to us. The other thing I would say is that we're talking about the global energy balance here, okay? And the global energy balance means we're really talking about very large areas on average, okay? On average, the Earth is warming. There are going to be some places that will cool, but on balance, more are going to warm, and the warming is going to outweigh the cooling. And the worse it gets, the fewer and fewer of those places that are going to be cool are going to get fine.
Thank you, Professor.
Professor, I have...
You know, I don't take apples.
I have to tell you, I don't ever think I've seen my vice chair blush, so... And you probably do know he is a teacher, so I think he that is why. So, thank you. Are there any other questions?
I think you're taking care of it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Professor, for being here. Appreciate it.
We don't take apples either.
Yeah, we'd have to report it if we do, so we can't take those. Okay, next we are going to have a panel talking about the likely effects of climate change on Oregon and the Pacific Northwest, and I've already had the advantage of hearing the next presentation this morning, so I'm excited because it was a wonderful presentation. We're going to hear about the impacts of climate change on water supply, and that's from Dr. Nolan, who's Associate Professor of the College of Science, the Department of Geosciences. And why don't you go ahead and identify yourself again for the record?
I'm Ann Nolan. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Geosciences, and I'm also the associate director of the Water Resources Graduate Program here at Oregon State. And
I also have to mention she does what many of us would like to do for a living. She spends a lot of her time on glaciers, probably on skis coming down. So,
right. Not as much.
Does this work? Some of us. Okay, we're a little challenged in technology.
I usually don't sit when I talk because I move around a lot, but I'll try to. So my background is actually in physical geography. I'm a geographer, and I started out with getting my PhD in Santa Barbara, which is a great place to think about snow. But then I moved to Colorado, which is a great place to actually spend a lot of time in snow, and then was hired here about 5.5 years ago, and I've really enjoyed my time here in Oregon. And I'm going to be talking about water resources from a snow and ice perspective, which is my area of expertise. So I'm not going to talk about aquifer storage and recovery and those kinds of issues, and you'll have to leave those to others in our geosciences department to fill you in on those details. I wanted to introduce some of the research that I've been doing and my students have been doing with by way of some research that Iris Stewart did when she was a PhD student down in Scripps. And this was published back in 2005, and what this shows is these circles, you'll see a lot of these circles, these sort of greenish-red circles are places where the timing of snowmelt has started occurring earlier in the season, in the spring, and that the onset of that pulse of water is occurring earlier, and the size of the circle corresponds to the number of days earlier. And Notice that there's a couple of blue circles here, and we were puzzling over this. In fact, one of my students in my snow hydrology class decided to reinvestigate this because we didn't think this was right, because all of our other research seems to indicate that Oregon is experiencing the same kinds of effects on its stream flow patterns that the rest of the United States is seeing. So in fact, we redid this, and some of this is in press right now in publication, but this is some of the work that was from this student. We were looking at the headwaters of the Mackenzie and the headwaters of the Deschutes. I know a couple of our representatives here today would be interested in this. And we found that the timing of springtime flow and most likely the snowmelt is occurring 15 days earlier over this 50-year period, 60-year period actually. So we started out in 1950 and here we are in the most recent period of time, and you can see, and by the way, these are both from similar climate cycle periods, so we can't really invoke difference in climate cycles here, but you can see that there's a very distinctive difference. So in fact, Oregon, at least these two places that we're looking, seem to reflect the same kinds of changes that we see elsewhere in the western United States. But of great interest to people who care about minimum in-stream flows is that this watershed showed a big decrease in August minimum flow, about 22-23% decrease. And that is not a projection. That is actually what has really happened. And so this is from this paper that we have in press right now. And you can see these two curves that are kind of mirroring each other. And these are these two historical periods, this 1948 to 1952 period and this 2001 to 2005 period. And you can see that this peak has shifted about 15-17 days, and that you come down into this recession limb much more, much quickly earlier in time, and so you have lower flows earlier in the years. Now, we took a model and we projected into the future on the order of 50 to 60 years, and what we see is that the flows are actually occurring, the peak flows are now occurring for this watershed, for this headwaters of the Mackenzie River, during the midwinter. So that has implications for flooding. But also notice that this recession limb is quite a bit lower. We haven't really changed the amount of precipitation. We've seen it redistributed, and what we see is that the you have low flows earlier and significantly lower low flows. And I want to point out that these are summarized in a piece of paper that I've handed out to the people on the dais. So one of the biggest effects is what I've termed this at-risk snow, and we see this conversion from snow to rainfall at lower elevations. And this area, which is the very, very dark red here, which is actually a really small proportion of the total snow area in the Pacific Northwest. It's tiny. It's only about 3%. But it's really concentrated at the low elevations. And in the Oregon Cascades, it represents about 22% of the area that would normally have snowfall in the core winter months, December, January, February. It's now going to be rain for the most part. And again, that's not to say that every winter you'll have rain there, because of course we have La Nina like we have this winter where we get really cold snowfall. But the frequency of warm winters would be expected to increase, and this is for about a 2 degrees Celsius increase in winter temperatures. Now, I wanted to make the point that we can't just look at climate and think about how to make projections for water resources only from climatic factors. We have to think about the setting. Water flows on the earth. Geology controls the type of flow. And here in Oregon, we have this very interesting geologic distribution. We have the Western Cascades with these old volcanic rocks. They're really well dissected. We have well-developed stream networks. Then we have the High Cascades up here, these beautiful young lavas, which are really fractured, and the water flows into them, and it's really a groundwater-dominated system. And it turns out that in this publication that I mentioned earlier, it turns out that we've been able to show that this slow recession of these groundwater-dominated streams are a lot more sensitive to changes in snowmelt amount and the timing of snowmelt. And so when we are looking at our measurements of climate and of snowpack and trying to project what might happen for water resources, we really need to think of both geology and climate together, we're not going to make accurate projections. So the effects of melting glaciers are also important. This is some work that one of my graduate students, Jeff Philippi, I think had to leave early for class. Oh, there you are, Jeff. Jeff has really spearheaded this work that was funded by the USGS. And so this photo taken by my friend Daryl Lloyd shows the change in the Elliott Glacier on the north side of Mount Hood from the previous was 2001, and here we have 2006, this recent photo. So a fairly substantial change. And you know, our iconic glaciers on Mount Hood are valuable for a variety of reasons, not just for recreation, but it turns out for the irrigation districts in this area of very high-value agriculture, the Hood River Valley. And so the upper middle fork Hood River, it's a very small watershed. And if you look at the fraction of the glaciation for the whole Hood River watershed, you can say, well, it's really insignificant. But if you look at where they take the water out at the irrigation districts up here, that's where it's important. And it actually is about almost 8% of the area is covered by glaciers, a little bit less now because they keep getting smaller. Until last summer, we didn't have any measurements of how much water was coming out of the glaciers. Anecdotally, people from Oregon Fish and Wildlife and irrigation districts would say, oh yeah, well, it's a hot summer, it's so dry. The end of the summer in August, if we didn't have the glaciers, the stream flow would be a lot less, and we think that the water would be a lot warmer. So Jeff went out there, and we've installed, with wilderness permits, water height recorders and calibrated all of this, and Jeff climbed down into crevasses in the glacier, and he's tied to a rope here, and collected and samples for isotopes to tease apart the part of the flow in the upper middle fork of the Hood River that's from glaciers and the part that's from groundwater. And the results of this really point at the fact that the glaciers really are a big contributor to this area. Where this water is being diverted is about 88%, and then lower down after the confluence of these two creeks, the Elliott and the Co, it's almost three-quarters of the flow. So it is really quite significant. And here's that watershed again. So the glaciers are right here, and they flow north up here. So it is a big number. And now these are new results that Jeff just came up with a couple of weeks ago, showing the projected flow at about 50 years using the current rates of glacier recession, that not including any projected temperature changes, just using what we know, how fast the glaciers have been receding, how fast they've been getting smaller. We haven't changed that rate. We've just been using the current rate. And we find that the glacier recedes by its area declines by about 50%, and the flows correspondingly decrease by about 50%. So at the diversions, that's about a 44% decrease, and then at the confluence of the Elliott and Co, it's about maybe 37% roughly. So this is a number that is very important to that, to those irrigation districts, the Middle Fork and the farmers' irrigation districts. But how do we know what kinds of changes to look for in the future, and how do we know what kinds of measurements we should be making? We have a big problem here in Oregon, and it's something that the rest of the Western United States is facing too. And so I think it's a challenge that we need to realize. The stream gauges are being discontinued. This is a USGS program, and a lot of these, some of it is state-funded too. There's some partnerships as well. But the gauges are not in the right place. They're below diversions. This is a map of all the dams in the Willamette and the Deschutes. We don't have a measure of natural flow. We can't really tell in very many places how the flow has changed or how it will change, because it's all below diversions and reservoirs. So I urge additional partnerships with USGS. And along these lines, one of my students, Amy Brown, who is from Bend, in the back of the room, I believe, developed this for the Willamette watershed, and we're working this up for the entire Columbia River Basin. In fact, this area in dark red is this at-risk snow area. And the green dots, these sort of yellowy green dots, are the places where we have snowpack measurements from snowtell sites. They're not in the right place. Very few of them, in fact, only two of them are within this so-called at-risk snow zone. And almost none of them, I think only one, is in this high snow zone where we might actually get increases and precipitation in the future. And so the snowpack measurements don't represent the distribution of snow, and they don't represent our anticipated distribution of snow. So we're not making the right kinds of measurements in the right places. And I'd like to offer that the state of California has recently begun investing significantly in what they call hydrologic observatories, using the latest and greatest measurement technologies and devising measurement systems that are facile, small, less expensive, and also span these incredible precipitation gradients that we have in the western United States. And so I offer that as an example of what we might think about in the future. And thank you. I just wanted to acknowledge some of my collaborators here.
Thank you, Dr. Nolan. And I just want to mention, and Representative Burley just reminded me, we did increase some funding for additional stream gauges last session. However, certainly knowledge is not enough, and we need more. And part of, colleagues, just so you know, the USGS budget has been cut significantly, and we've been able to leverage state dollars in the past, and basically what we're finding is a lot less federal dollars that are coming in to do these type of measurements. And so we really need to think about, if we want to have good information, especially, you know, looking at the impacts of climate change and how we can address that, that's something we're going to have to be thinking about as the agencies are putting together their budgets, and I'm talking with the Water Resources Department about that. So I think we had a question from Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just maybe a combination question. Do you know where the gauges ought to be placed now? What is the magnitude of the cost for the gauges and for the measuring the keeping measurements? Obviously, it takes labor to do that in addition to equipment. And what kind of implications does having those measurements make for policymakers like us? I'm thinking about water use and maybe a variety of other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, this came up in a presentation I gave earlier today. There have been gauges that have been discontinued that we could put back online, and that would be a really good first step. And towards putting in new gauges, I think what we need to think about is sampling representative watersheds. And what do we think of? What is a representative watershed? Well, it might be one that's well represented in this Western Cascades geologic setting, or High Cascades geologic setting, or a set of watersheds perhaps that span this precipitation gradient, you know, as we go from the west to the east. And I'm not just talking about the Cascades, too. I think the Wallowas and other mountains in the east are important to sample as well. And so I think what we need to, we have worked up a schema for developing representative watersheds, and it's still unpublished, but it's some of the work that my colleagues here at Oregon State have been involved in. And so we'd be happy to share that. I think really what's important for us as scientists, in order to get the right kind of information to you as policymakers, we need to understand what natural flows are doing. So we need gauges that are above dams and diversions in order to really understand changes in flow, and even just to get a baseline. So representative watersheds, natural flow, and putting back online some of these discontinued stream gauges.
And then if I may, just simply a translation.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. It's really not a follow-up. It's a different subject. You had an earlier slide in which you talked about groundwater versus well-developed streams. I don't remember the exact language you used.
Mm-hmm.
Just from looking at your map, it looked as though you were basically referring to the Deschutes for the groundwater and the Willamette for the for the other. I'm assuming that those have very significant implications for water use in Central Oregon, and I think that's a yes or no.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other quick questions for Dr. Nolan? Thank you very much, and I know that you're going to be following up with the Oregon Water Resources Department, since they were here this morning to hear that presentation about stream gauging locations and needs. So thank you for that excellent presentation. Moving right along, because we've got a lot of good information I want to make sure we can provide time for, Ron Nielsen. And for the record, just please state your name and affiliation. I'll be right.
It's going to be challenging.
You don't have to
be right.
So Sorry.
Her severe laryngitis.
Well, would you want to have Jim Wilson speaking?
No, I'll speak. I'm Lynn Nielsen. I work with the USDA Forest Service. I'm also a courtesy professor in the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology and in the Department of Forestry. And please, if you do not understand me, let me know. And apologies to Representative Burley, who's had to sit through much of this for the last few weeks. I don't have time to acknowledge my colleagues, so I'll move along. Just a statement about who we are. There are only two groups in the world who routinely supply the IPCC with global simulations of vegetation change. It's a distributional change and it's functional change, both in terms of carbon change and fire and all of these things. And this is all done from first principles. These are mechanistic models. They are not statistical correlations. And we were honored to actually be on the cover of their second assessment report in 1995. And so we're actually the only team on this continent that does this kind of work. And the models operate at all spatial scales from, we developed it actually on a grid at 50 meter resolution in Wind Cave National Park, and it simulates grasslands, savannas, forests, and shrublands among, there are 35 or more different kinds of vegetation actually simulated in the model, but it simulates the distribution of functional types like conifer tree in competition with grasses. And so the processes in the model are analogous to the processes in the climate models. That is, we go back to physiology, leaf level physiology, and the competition among different plants at a very fine spatial scale, and then just blankly throw them out over these huge scales. So just to reiterate a little bit what Jeff said, there are three different emission scenarios I'm going to talk about. This is the high-end emission scenario, kind of business as usual, a sort of a middle-of-the-road emission scenario, and then a low-end emission scenario. This one, I believe, equilibrates at around 550 parts per million CO2. Jim Hansen of NASA has recently come out with testimony saying we really need to stabilize at about 350 parts per million if we are to avoid the breakup of the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets, which could dramatically raise sea levels within this century by meters, not feet. We're bracketing the sensitivity. These are three different global climate models, just to bracket some of the uncertainty from low temperature sensitivity to high temperature sensitivity. What's most interesting is to look at the rainfall, and as we've discovered, this projector doesn't do colors very well. As Jeff said, all of the models show the rainfall increases globally. All of the models show that most of that rainfall increase goes to the high latitudes. All of the models show drying in the subtropical desert belt, where there are differences among the models is where does that contact zone lie between the high latitude rainfall increases and the lower latitude rainfall decreases. And as it happens, we have the luck of being right in the middle of that uncertainty zone. Now, the other thing that we're discovering is that the ocean goes through different climate regime changes. The Pacific Decadal Oscillation is one we've been hearing a lot about, and we've got El Nino and La Nina oscillations. And when you go into a La Nina, the Northwest goes dry, as is being shown in this simulation right here. And when you go into a positive multi-decade Pacific decay oscillation, the Northwest also goes dry. This is the first time these global climate models have actually shown drying in the Northwest in these scenarios. Most of the models actually show increases in rainfall in the Northwest, but frankly what I'm most concerned about is not whether rainfall increases or decreases, but whether we have these drastic decade-long changes between wet times and dry times. And so I think that in that sense, both may be right. We're completing a set of simulations that go from global scale down to this continental scale and down to very high resolution landscape scales using these 9 future scenarios. So I'm just going to show you a little cutout of this continental scale. This is a simulation, thank you, of that was very helpful. This is a simulation of vegetation distribution under current climate. It's not perfect, but it's not bad. Hal Salwasser shared the development of a book that is on the Oregon Forest Resources Institute website. In there is a chapter 3, that is written by Connie Millar and myself. And most of the results that I'm going to talk about now, you can read about in more detail in that report, as well as some of the future climate scenarios. The climate scenarios in this report are a little earlier, but frankly, they don't tell any different stories. And the vegetation simulations that are in this report are at a more coarse resolution than I'm going to show you. But again, they don't really tell a different story than what I'm going to show you today. This is an important historical temperature trend. Jeff talked about this over the past 100 years. This cooling trend in the 1940s to 1970s is also very important. And that corresponds with a multi-decade shift in the Pacific decadal oscillation where it went negative. It was positive before then, especially during the 1930s drought, and it's been positive more or less ever since then. Occasional flip-flops, and much of our weather is associated with these multi-decade ocean climate regime changes and also their interaction with the higher frequency oscillations like El Nino, La Nina. So if you get a La Nina happening at the same time as a positive Pacific decadal oscillation, you get huge wet events, and that happened in 83 and in 98. And then we also had corresponding dry events in 87 and 98. But since this change, the entire color of our variability has changed. Before this mid-1970s change, our weather was relatively benign from one year to the next. It didn't vary very much. But since this change in the mid-1970s, the entire West, including the Northwest, has been whipsawed, you've heard that many times before, between two massive wet-dry cycles. And so the critical issue is this variability. If you go wet-dry, 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 your ecosystems and your streams don't care much. If you take those same years and rearrange them to go wet, 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 the ecosystems just grow, 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 and put on lots and lots of leaf area. And that leaf area is like a candle wick that just pulls the water out of the soil. And this, in fact, is how the models work. They find that maximum leaf area that can be supported and just use up the available water resources during the growing season. And so the corollary to that statement, though, is that ecosystems everywhere, almost everywhere in the world, are nearly always in their normal condition at a drought threshold. No matter whether you're in a forest or a savanna or a grassland, they have found that upper limit of leaf area carrying capacity. And so all you need to do is heat it up a little bit, lengthen the growing seasons, increase the rate of evaporative demand, and that whole landscape will suddenly dry out because you've got too many leaves. And the whole system can go into massive drought stress, and you get a massive dieback. And this is actually happening across the West, in our opinion, juniper ecosystems, right? This, in fact, is how the models work. They find that maximum leaf area that can be supported and just use up the available water resources during the growing season. And so the corollary to that statement, though, is that ecosystems everywhere, almost everywhere in the world, are nearly always in their normal condition at a drought threshold. No matter whether you're in a forest or a savanna or a grassland, they have found that upper limit of leaf area carrying capacity. And so all you need to do is heat it up a little bit, lengthen the growing seasons, increase the rate of evaporative demand, and that whole landscape will suddenly dry out. Because you've got too many leaves, and the whole system can go into massive drought stress, and you get a massive dieback. And this is actually happening across the West, in our opinion, juniper ecosystems right now, and it's happening in lodgepole pine and other ecosystems across the West right now that have grown up and hit these drought cycles. And so you go wet, and then you go dry, and those ecosystems just die back. And that's like tripping dominoes. They get drought stressed, and they get attacked by insects and diseases. And so you have all of these things happening consequentially. Now, what Ann did not mention in her talk is that two-thirds of the water falls out of the sky, goes up through these ecosystems on average. And so when you heat up these ecosystems and they grab most of that water, your streams dry up. But then if the ecosystems die, they quit pulling that water out of the soil. And so that two-thirds that would be going up in the air is suddenly going down the streams. And so you go, your streams actually then amplify the effect of the ecosystem response, and you would go into huge drought and flood cycles in your streams. This is just a simulation. This is observed vegetation distribution, highly lumped up, and this is simulated vegetation distribution, highly aggregated. I want to focus on this green area in the maritime forest, and I'm also going to talk about this lighter green area, which is the interior dry continental forest, a kind of a ponderosa pine type of ecosystems, as well as juniper ecosystems. And this would be everything west of the Cascades crest, wet interior ecosystems. And this repeats that historical simulation for comparison. And so this set of postage stamps, I'm going to point some bottom lines. The amount of area in gray, which is sagebrush, goes down in every single one of these simulations. And the reason it goes down is that you have woody expansion, a continuation of the woody expansion that is going on right now. It continues with shrubland with trees and junipers expanding out into sagebrush, also pushing grasses out in front of it. Those are dry ecosystems, and so putting wood in those dry ecosystems increases the fuel load, so you also increase fire. Notice the color change in the wet ecosystems. You go into all of these scenarios and you see changes of color. What that means is that broadleaf trees from the south, for example, down in the Siskiyou area, where you have broadleaf evergreen trees and even broadleaf deciduous trees, are expanding north. And this happened 5 or 6,000 years ago in the middle Holocene thermal maximum, when a chaparral zone down here in this Klamath region expanded all the way up to Puget Sound. And that was at the low end of a magnitude of temperature change that we're forecasting for the possible next century. I wish this showed up better. This is just looking at percent change in vegetation carbon in these ecosystems, comparing the last 30 years average carbon density in these ecosystems to the 1961 to 90 baseline period. Now, Representative Burley asked a very excellent question. What's baseline? And I'm going to come back to that in a moment when I talk about carbon, because there is no appropriate baseline. The choice of 61 to 90 is arbitrary. And the climatologists defined a 3-year period a half a century or more ago as a, quote, normal. And that was at a time when we didn't think climate changed very much. And so every 10 years, they redefined that normal period and move it up. And so now the normal is 1970 to 2000. But what we've now discovered is that these are very, very different periods, both in terms of the variability of the climate as well as the kinds of climate. But what I'm pointing out, what happens here is that in these lighter blue colors, those are increases in carbon density, and those are mostly concentrated in the interior dry ecosystems. But you do see them also in the wetter ecosystems under only those scenarios where rainfall increases. Now, these ecosystems, I have to tell you, also benefit from a physiological effect of elevated carbon dioxide concentration, which increases their water use efficiency, and that is incorporated in these simulations. Now, I recognize there's debate in the literature about the efficacy of that. Most of that debate is focused on carbon. When you pin these physiologists down on the effect on water use efficiency, which is how much carbon you can fix per unit of water you transpire, that number is pretty immutable. That does not really change. And it's just where the carbon goes. Does it go through the ecosystem and back out, or does it go into the soil, or does it go into the above ground biomass? Depends entirely on whether it's a young ecosystem or an old ecosystem, whether it's at its water limited carrying capacity or whether it's right after a cut. And so you can't really trust conclusions about the CO2 effect on carbon because they're not in context. You have to put them in a context and look at the water use efficiency. The water use efficiency increase is going to happen. So carbon is likely slated to continue going up in the interior ecosystems. Fire also goes up in those ecosystems. And this slide, the blues are decreases in fire. This is comparing a half a century now, the last half century of the 20th century to the last half century of the 21st century. And it goes up mostly in the interior dry ecosystems again. You put wood in there and it's like pouring fuel on fire. On the other hand, it also goes up in the wet ecosystems. It doesn't show up well on this slide, but it does on these Hadley, this whole series where the wets where the Northwest gets drier, then even the wetter ecosystems go up in flames, and their carbon density goes down. And so there is uncertainty as to even the sign of the change in both carbon and fire on the wet ecosystems. There is less uncertainty about the sign of the change on the interior dry ecosystems with respect to carbon increases and increases in fire. But let's take a closer look. This is the average. This is the time series showing the historical time series of carbon change simulated over the past 100 years for those interior dry forests, and the increase under all three scenarios. And this is the change in biomass consumed by fire under all three of these scenarios, as well as for the past 100 years. This shows that there should have been big fires back in 1976, and frankly, I haven't looked back to check to see if that actually happened. But I think it may have. 1976, or this might have been actually this in 69, I'd have to check the numbers on that. This is the maritime ecosystem, and the change in carbon over the last 100 years and the change in biomass consumed by fire. This is 1976, where it shows there was a ding in carbon and should have been some fires. We probably put those out, which means we probably didn't actually see this change in fires. But 1976 was when the globe went from cooling to warming, and it was probably one of the most extreme climate years on the planet of the last 20th century. And I don't know for sure, but I think the Northwest did go dry that year, and the East Coast, east of the Rockies, was extremely cold and wet.
Go ahead, keep going.
Okay, this is my last slide. But the important thing here also is this one question here is on carbon, is what's your baseline? If you're going to count carbon in these ecosystems, is what's your baseline of how much carbon you should hold in those ecosystems and what's healthy for those ecosystems and where they should go in the future? If the climate says those ecosystems are going to go down, what would you do for your carbon accounting? But then zoom in to if you're going to do carbon accounting, you're going to do it at a project level. So let's zoom in to just one of those grid cells, and this is more analogous to a project level, and this is on the interior ponderosa pine type of ecosystem, and this shows the thing was growing continuously from 1900 up to about 1975, and there was a big burn, and it started to regrow, and here it is at the end of the 20th century. And then this is where three different scenarios show it. One of them shows it just kind of continuing on, and then another burn, and then it continues to grow. And then the other two scenarios show that it would just sort of slightly increase. So in looking at this project level, what would be your baseline? And then how would you know which of these scenarios is actually going to happen in the future? We don't know. And so you can't say what your future target should be on a project level in terms of a target baseline. But that doesn't mean all is lost. Two things. One is the future is uncertain, and we have to resort to scenario analysis in order to get a sense of what might happen as opposed to what will happen. We will never be able to tell you what will happen. That's simply off the table now. The future will not echo the past. We now have to recognize that everything is changing. And it's changing at an extraordinarily rapid rate, particularly look at Ann's glacier slides. And so now instead of managing for the status quo, we are managing for change. And we're managing for change under an uncertain future. And so we have to think about these ecosystems in terms of desired function. For example, if you want these ecosystems to be healthy, you do not want them at their water-limited leaf area carrying capacity, because they will go into dieback if it warms up. And so one suggestion is to keep those ecosystems at a lower density. On the other hand, if they're at too low a density, they're not going to be pulling in very much carbon. So somewhere in between, they're going to be pulling in a lot of carbon. They're also going to be giving you clean water. They're going to be healthy. They will not be drought stressed. And if they're not drought stressed, they will not be diseased as much. So function may precede condition in terms of what you're managing for. There may be some high-value ecosystems that you would endangered species and such that you want to maintain in the status quo, and you can do that. But the cost of doing that will gradually increase because you're trying to hold back the tide, and you have to recognize that cost. In a long-term sense, there are two things that you might do, and I'm not speaking for my agency. I'm speaking for myself. These are not policy recommendations necessarily, but I would suggest you want to keep the density of these forests or all ecosystems below their water-limited carrying capacity. How would you do that? Thin them. How would you thin them? You're not going to do it on the government dime. I think the only way you're going to be able to do it is engage a workforce and put perhaps a lot of biomass energy conversion plants out there and turn that biomass into fuel and make it into electricity. That means a whole new infrastructure. And so you can put dollars into 50 new coal-fired power plants, or you can put it into a new infrastructure that, in fact, can help take biomass and convert it into energy. That's a function, and it also gives you healthier ecosystems. You're not going to know where the future species composition of those ecosystems is going to go. So plant diversity. Do not plant monocultures. Plant a diversity of genotypes, a diversity of species, and plant a diversity of mosaics across your landscapes so that different parts of your landscapes have different opportunities to do different things. And your forest management community is already doing this. You can go up in the hills out here right now and find where they have cut and they are planting Douglas fir and grand fir and ponderosa pine, all in the same places. But you also need to think you may get broadleaf trees coming into some of these places. And so think diversity and think water-limited carrying capacity. And then lastly, this is really important. You have a water subcommittee. You probably have a carbon subcommittee of some sort or another. There may be a fire subcommittee, but they cannot think independently of each other. This is a huge, incredibly complex, interactive system, and you need to manage it that way as an interactive, coupled system. So your water resources and your carbon dynamics and your fire management are all happening at once. And I think if you do it right, it really can be a win-win-win operation for species diversity, for ecosystem health, to reduce species disease, and keep function up and keep healthy water resources.
Thank you so much, Ron. Appreciate it. And really appreciate you being here, even though I know that it's been tough with the laryngitis. I think you had a question, and then...
I'll be very brief, okay, Madam Chair, and I'm not going to ask you a question because you actually answered most of them, and every time I've seen your presentation, I'm learning more and more. I appreciate that, but there's only one thing I just wanted to say for the record here, Dr. Nielsen, and I have to respectfully differ with you a little bit. Though I absolutely agree and support the notion of thinning in the biomass and the energy, and we've done actually a lot of things to incent that through the tax credits and the 2210 bill last year, etc., I would differ with you in that we don't need an entirely new industry and infrastructure to do that. I would submit that we can use our existing forest products infrastructure and perhaps diversify and augment to be able to pick that up. But most of the biomass plants to date are co-located with existing mills, and I would expect that we could continue.
I would certainly defer to your strategic design on forming in a new infrastructure. In the longer run, you're going to ultimately have to move from a centralized energy supply to a decentralized energy supply, be it wind, water, waves, and biomass.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions?
Very quickly, if I may. In this model that you've described, is there any place for carbon sequestration? And I don't need you to tell me specifically what it is, but does it even exist in this model?
The model simulates carbon directly.
Yes.
And so carbon sequestration, I'm not sure how you're defining it. I'm
thinking about it in the terms of taking carbon out of the air permanently. Even if it's only a fraction of the actual carbon in the cycle.
I understand what you're saying, yes. And there are two ways to look at this. And one is to think of ecosystems, I use the term, as a bank, and each ecosystem has a capacity. It can only hold so much. And once you've filled that capacity, that's it. It's capped, you're fine, done. And you can manage for that bank. You certainly can. That's what I was trying to point out, however, in that last slide, that you have a great deal of difficulty in even defining for any given project what the size of that bank is going to be. On the other hand, the other way to count carbon, and I think of it as carbon sequestration, but it's often referred to as a trade-off, and that is the carbon coming in through the system is like a carbon pump, and that has no cap. You can pull carbon out of the air, use the ecosystems as a solar collector, in effect, trap that energy in the battery of carbon, and turn it into electricity, and you can measure that very precisely. It's like the meter on the outside of your house. You don't know how, you don't care how many light bulbs you have in it. You just can precisely measure what goes through it.
Thank you for that excellent answer, and appreciate being here tonight. I'm sure we'll have some follow-up at future meetings, because we'll have lots more discussions about sequestration as well. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. Next, we're going to have Jack Barth up talk about oceans. And for the record, can you make sure and introduce yourself, please? This is Dr. Barth. I should be calling everyone doctors here, probably.
Good afternoon. I'm Jack. I'm Jack Barth. I'm a professor of oceanography and ecology of oceanic and atmospheric sciences here at OSU. And we just had an excellent introduction, actually several introductions, to how the climate system works and how important the ocean is in both regulating climate and also providing resources to us. So I'm going to take you out to the coastal strip here, and I'm going to tell you what we know that is certain about change in the oceans and what are some likely changes. And I'm just going to march down through that list, talking about temperature and sea level that we've already heard about. Say a little bit about waves, acidity, which is a new surprise, how the winds might change, and recent changes in the oxygen content of the water. This is off Cape Perpetua, if you might have been there. The oceans are warming. We can measure that. This is the upper layer of the ocean. It's 0 to 3,000 meters, and in all the ocean basins, there's a trend up. There is variability about that, both geographic and over decadal time scales, but the basic trend is up. Now, what that'll do to the ocean is it warms that surface layer, it sort of caps it off, so we get less of communication down to that deeper, colder water. And also that idea of moving things from the atmosphere into the ocean, that's slowed down by this warming. Sea level is increasing. We've seen this plot before, the one on the upper right there. That's the IPCC assessment, showing the instrumental record, and then the projections into the future. And that's due to a couple effects, which many of us have heard about. It's thermal expansion and the melting of ice. And it's about an inch a decade. And I just want to point out that it really depends locally on what the land is doing. So off our tectonically active coast, some of the land is going up, some is going down. But from Florence to Astoria, land is being submerged at about that global rate, which is about an inch a decade. if you look at the records for wave heights along the U.S. West Coast, these are from buoys offshore, and it goes from south to north. And let's just go over, look at this curve over here. This is the maximum wave height in the winter. And look at the units down here. These are meters, so that's 33 feet there. And out here is at about 50 feet. And you see that the biggest waves are off Oregon. And if you look, as Paul Comer and Jonathan Allen of Dogami have, at various seasons, you can start to see pretty big waves in here. So this is starting in the El Nino years, running up to here. And I actually added the December 3rd storm of 07. There's 10 and 12-meter, 14-meter waves on here. The point is that the 100-year storm wave back in 96 was 33 feet. But there's a whole lot more bigger than that now. And waves are getting bigger. The new 100-year storm wave now is almost 50 feet. This storm took out almost all of our ocean observation networks. Okay, those two things together, increased sea level and waves, lead to coastal erosion. This is another sort of unexpected but widespread effect. That is, as you take CO2 from the atmosphere and you put it into the ocean. Now this is the going from the surface of the ocean down with depth, 3,000 meters, and going on a slice here all through the Pacific. And the red basically just says there's more CO2 in the water than there was before industrial times. And it's penetrated throughout the ocean. And what it does is it makes the water more acidic. And we can actually measure the pH and show that there's a reduction in the surface pH. It's becoming more acidic, and that's a prediction for the 21st century. It has a direct biological impact. That is, organisms that are trying to form shells can't do that as efficiently. Many of the plankton that form the base of the food web are subject to that. And these little guys that are called pteropods, which are planktonic snails, that's a very important food source, in particular for salmon. One of my colleagues refers to them as the potato chips of the sea. These guys are having more difficulty, even now, forming their shells. So we're really fundamentally impacting the food web. Let's talk about the wind a little bit. In Oregon here, we're connected to both the larger atmosphere and the larger ocean. Let's look in the ocean. We've got the west wind drift coming across the Pacific, bringing waters to our Oregon shelf. These are the atmospheric winds. They flow around this big wind gyre, and they're blowing to the south here in the summer. And that has a very important effect on our system. As the wind blows to the south, the surface currents are actually pushed offshore, and that's an effect of the rotation of the earth. We have to fill that in from a blow, and we get cold, nutrient-rich water. When that hits the light zone, we get these incredible plankton blooms. So looking down from a satellite, you can see the cold water along the coast. This is from August, so as you all know, if you go out to the coast in the summer, it's cold. It's because of this cold water right here. And as we also know, it affects our climate immediately, both through cooling via sea breezes and at larger scales through these decadal shifts that Dr. Nielsen talked about. If you look at the ecosystem response, all this red stuff is a soupy green brown water that's plankton, and that's going to fuel all this wonderful fish production that we benefit from off Oregon. This is just a photograph of that down off Port Orford. Okay, so let's talk about how winds might change and what's important about that. They could change in strength. It could get stronger or weaker. They could change in direction. I just told you how important the direction is to generating this food source for the higher trophic levels. Dr. Nielsen also talked about seasonality and the natural rhythms. That's very important in the ocean, and I'm going to give you an example of that. For example, here are those winds to the south I was talking about in the summer.
in the winter, they're to the north. We've got a nice seasonal cycle, and we go through something called the spring transition. If we shift that cycle, if we change the rhythm of the oceans, we're going to upset that entire food web, and I'll show you an example of that. One of the hypotheses and predictions of global warming is that the land will warm more because the ocean is such a large reservoir of cold water. That increases the land-sea temperature difference, and it will increase the wind along the coast. So here's just two examples from the last couple of years. These are measurements from a buoy offshore of Newport. And what I'm trying to show here is spring through summer, and going in this direction are what I call good winds. These are winds that are going to drive that ecosystem response. And the line here is normal, and the gray bars about that are the standard deviations. In 2005, we basically missed the spring transition. We didn't switch over to the summer for over 2 months. So, in fact, any organisms... from a buoy offshore of Newport. And what I'm trying to show here is spring through summer. And going in this direction are what I call good winds. These are winds that are going to drive that ecosystem response. And the line here is normal, and the gray bars about that are the standard deviations. In 2005, we basically missed the spring transition. We didn't switch over to the summer for over 2 months. So, in fact, any organisms relying on that plankton did not get fed early in the spring. And what we saw from that was massive marine die-offs. There were many seabirds killed off. The murres were dying along the shore. And in fact, this year in 2008, we're seeing very bad salmon returns, and we think we can trace that back to this lack of ocean production several years earlier. This was just a recent article in the Oregonian. Now, what happens if you go the other direction? You heard me say that we might increase the winds. This is what happened in 2006. We started off normal, and the wind blew strongly and persistently for the entire summer. We had twice as much wind as we were normal. And what that does is it fuels those incredible plankton blooms, and those can actually sink to the bottom and consume the oxygen through decay in the water and lead to these massive die-offs of invertebrates. So that's yet another disruption of the ecosystem. Now what I want you to note next is that these are two extremes in 2 years. So here's the envelope of normalcy. 05, less upwelling. 06, more than we'd seen. So again, harking back to that swings, the variability becoming bigger. I'd like to say a little bit about this lack of oxygen in the waters we've been seeing, just because it's been so much in the news lately. So hypoxia, this term is lack of oxygen, and the area of the water we're talking about is near the bottom. Up near the surface, if you measure the oxygen, there's plenty of oxygen. It's exchanged with the atmosphere through wave breaking, etc. So if you go out and take an instrument and measure right down, say, off Newport to the bottom, you'll find this area near the bottom that's hypoxic. And below this number, 1.4, you really get some impacts on marine life. And what we've been documenting recently is the severity of this, and the size of the water column that's being affected. These are some of the biological impacts. We've worked with ODFMW to investigate. This is a normal rockfish community in about 50 meters of water right off Cape Perpetua. In 02, we saw fish die-offs. These are piles of Dungeness crabs in the intertidal. They should not be there. This is a sea star feeding on a crab in the intertidal. That should not happen. This guy was killed offshore and brought in. In 2006, the remotely operated vehicle surveys went to this area, did not see a single fish. These are piles of Dungeness crab carcasses. There's worms in here. The majestic sea anemones had fallen over. The sea stars were dying off. Is this unusual? We've heard about baselines and what we can measure. This is the historical data set from 1950 to 1999, and it's from all these samples off the coast here. So anytime an oceanographer goes out and makes a measurement, and many of these were taking water samples, bringing them back into the lab, we had to go into the OSU archives and pull the numbers out of the old data reports. This is the dissolved oxygen high near the surface. Goes down to hypoxic water near the bottom. This water never sees the sea surface, okay? We're bringing our water up to the surface from about here. And so up in the shallow waters next to Oregon, there is no hypoxia. Let me paint in now for you the recent years. These are our measurements in this area, right off central Oregon. Not only is it below this cutoff of 1.4, we're getting right down to zero. That's termed anoxia, or lack, complete zero oxygen. So we think that this is unprecedented, at least in the instrumental record. So I'm going to try to be brief. I just wanted to give you a flavor of what we know for certainty. We know certain that the sea surface temperature is warm. We know for certain that sea level is going up. It will continue to go up. There's nothing you can do right now to stop that. There are bigger waves due to the storminess. We're acidifying the ocean. That's going to be difficult to reverse. There are likely stronger winds, and really this potential change in rhythm. We sometimes use the term arrhythmia from the medical field, where we're changing the natural rhythms in the oceanic ecosystems. And then again, this increased occurrence of hypoxia. And I just want to echo some of the questions that have been asked, as well as Dr. Newsom's comments. There are challenges in detecting these trends among the year-to-year and the decadal variability. And we're definitely in a La Nina this year. This is the El Nino index down here, and the blue colors indicate a La Nina this year. But again, we have the decadal oscillations on top of that. So that's what I have for today.
Thank you so much for that excellent presentation. Any questions on specifically on the ocean impacts? Climate change? And well, I had one as far as what do you expect to see this year in the crab fisheries. Do you have any sense if we're going to see a repeat of what happened a couple of years ago?
One quick comment about the crab fishery. It's actually at its best in the winter months, and the measurements I'm showing are from the summer. We have very little knowledge of that connection between that death in the summer and the fishery in the winter. We're desperately working with ODS and W and NOAA to take marine life samples connection. I've pretty much gone on the record that I expect to see more of the hypoxia in the years to come.
Well, fortunately, that's not good news, especially for our coastal and fishing economy, so we appreciate that. I certainly will have you come back and give us updates, because sure. I think this is really important information to have. So thank you so much. And we're moving right along. We're going to I'll let committee members know we're going to go over. I'd hope to end by 4, but we want to leave time for public comment, so we'll probably go till 4:30. So certainly if folks have to leave, understand that, but want to make sure we leave time for public comment. And also, we will not hear the update on the Western Climate Initiative today. We will ask David Van Pop from the governor's office to send out an email to all the committee members, and certainly Beth can make that available to anybody who's interested.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Since we're going to be going over, I just want to make a comment. Representative Hovey and I have something back in the district. We do have to leave here at 4, so we apologize to those who we will not be able to hear from, but we'll listen to the record.
Well, and we appreciate you being here today. Okay, next we're going to hear from Dr. Coakley.
My name is Stella Coakley. I'm an associate dean in the College of Agricultural Sciences. My background is in plant pathology. I've worked in the area of climate change and its impact on plant diseases since the mid-1970s. Fortunately, my colleagues have laid a beautiful groundwork, and I will not duplicate their presentation. The impacts of change for agriculture nationally is not overall particularly dire. However, depending on where you're located will depend on whether you have a major or minor impact. Unfortunately, the variable of not being able to predict makes this extremely difficult and often very economically challenging for production agriculture to adjust in a timely way. I want to say that first and foremost, the biggest challenge for agriculture in Oregon will be the availability of a sufficient quantity and quality of water when needed. And I will not go into the details beyond saying that you're receiving a very nice summary that was done for those behind me about 18 months ago that summarizes water issues in Oregon relative to predominantly agriculture natural resources. So overall, the economic aggregate impact, and I thank Dr. John Antle from Montana State University for providing me with this slide. Dr. Antle, who is an expert in climate to environmental resource economics, will be joining the faculty at Oregon State University in about 18 months' time. And for the Pacific Northwest, it looks better than many regions. If we have the water, we'll be fine as far as productivity is concerned. Clearly, the rate of change and the lack of predictability of change is going to make it somewhat difficult to manage. There will definitely be regional differences in Oregon where you're at. You may have more precipitation, therefore greater productivity. In other areas, there may be actually less. The greatest impact in agriculture most likely will be on the perennial crops, those multi-year investments, the tree fruits, vineyards, even your grass seed fields, your things that are put in. Potential huge impact in forestry area, and I always appreciate Ron mentioning the disease and pests, because they definitely are a greater challenge in stressed ecosystems. And I'm not going to say much about the animal husbandry production, because that is not my area. However, there are apt to be impacts there as well, both in open range and contained livestock, particularly when you have extremes of climate events. And that is another aspect of climate change that makes it difficult, is that the extremes are greater And again, they are largely unpredictable. I'm going to show you a set of slides that were kindly loaned to me by Dr. Gregory Jones, who is a viticulturist professor at Southern Oregon University. And this is going to show you in a very real way. He's internationally known for his work in grape production and the impacts of climate change, potential impacts. And in a sense, this isn't, again, about it being all bad. In fact, it's probably much better for Oregon and Washington than it is for California, because you will be moving your grapes into an increasing number of favorable areas. So look at this as a positive spin for climate change, if you have your water. And I'm going to go through this fairly quickly, so don't try to digest the slides, and I'm sorry, I'm not free to share them beyond what I show you here today. There is a publication coming out by Dr. Jones fairly soon, and for obvious reasons, we would prefer to leave it in his hands with his copyright. If you look up, this is my magic pointer, the colors, and here just focus on the different colors represent different zones currently used are available for grape growing, buying specifically wine grape growing in California and the Pacific Northwest. So you can see the Walla Walla Valley, Willamette Valley, Napa Valley. And the varying colors, and actually I think it's the wall, not the projector, that's causing the color distortions, that you can see very big differences. And we already know that the wines in Oregon are quite different than those in California in terms of what can you grow here as opposed to what you grow there.
We also know they're much better, right?
Well, there is that also. So just looking at the regions, and this is a way in which the wine growers sort of think about what can they grow. Now, let's look at what happens, and just look at the change in colors. With 1 degree, you start seeing differences. You'd see an increase, actually, in the Pacific Northwest. You also discover that there's a good chunk of California is losing its ability to grow wine at all. And again, you can see the different regions changing. Well, you can see what happens when you have 3 degrees. And again, this is centigrade, not Fahrenheit. So these are models. There is evidence for the warming impact already. Now, why does this matter? And I'm going to go through this one quickly. When you have too cold a threshold, you've got low sugar levels, you get it too warm, you've got a lower retention of acids, overripe, you get an optimum zone, and that's for each variety. And in a minute, I'm going to show you sort of some of all the varieties that you can have. And so you've got that optimum zone. Well, think about Southern Oregon and think about moving your vineyards north, and recognizing that when you make a vineyard investment, any wine growers in the group, how many years are you investing for?
20 at least.
Probably, a minimum. So you're going to need to have varieties that either can adapt or you can manage for the short-term, long-term. And I might say that this can apply to a lot of aspects of other crops, which is your plant diseases, your insect pests, and even your weeds invade into managed ecosystems. If they get an edge or an advantage, they're much faster at adapting than the host plant's going to be. And in the case of the trees, you can't just pick up and move them. That's an advantage of animal agriculture and annual crops. So the warmer climate is going to cause a shift to the types of crops, and this is true not just for wine grapes. And if you recall back to one of Ron's slides, that A2 integration, well, here's an example of how it's being used relative to what could happen with growing your wine grapes. And so you're going to have a shifting of your zones, and it's going, you know, there's variables. There's going to be the water issue. There's going to be soil quality, quantity of nutrients, and what's happening over time. Now, let's look just very briefly at how you differentiate the growing zones for all the different wines. And if you ever get a chance to hear Greg Jones speak, go take the opportunity because he gives a wonderful presentation. If you look across the top, you've got ranges of average growing season temperatures, the cool, intermediate, warm, and then hot, and then you've got the kinds of wines that can be made out of those areas. And so if we look at the Willamette Vineyard, that shows you where you are now and what happens if you warm up 2.3 Fahrenheit. Now I've shifted to Fahrenheit out of centigrade, so this is not a very large shift. But you suddenly go from your Pinot Noir, you're moving over into your some things I can't even pronounce, Cerulean, Cabernet, Dochette. If you were down in California, you'd be really in trouble here. Now, if you look for Southern Oregon, with a 2.5, and these are sort of predicted, again, you see this moving across. And that's the numbers for Eastern Oregon. Now, it's not too hard to consider that for some regions this could be just great if you have your water. So I think focusing on the water piece becomes a very, very important aspect. I'm going to stop there. It is impossible to cover all of Oregon's agriculture in this short period of time. I think, though, hopefully the message is encouraging to you is that we can adjust as long as we have the resources to deploy the technology to make the adjustments in a period sufficiently short enough to keep our producers in business. Now, I want to stress that at Oregon State University, the College of Agricultural Sciences also has responsibility for fisheries and wildlife and for issues of marine mammal health and well-being. So our concern isn't just production agriculture, it's natural resource management and trying to protect all aspects of our state's economy.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Simply, Madam Chair, simply to note, it's a very discouraging report to me as one who is a working Pinot Noir, and you basically told us it won't go here anymore.
Well, maybe that'll serve as a motivation to reduce those things that are driving global warming. I mean, you know.
I'm going to drink Willamette Valley Cabernet Sauvignon because that's what will grow here when that global warming time comes.
I think actually my point of illustration is there is evidence that we already are seeing an impact, and that is, you know, this comes home in a way that just talking about it theoretically doesn't. If you move up into state of Washington, Canada, and look at what's happening with some of their tree diseases, and in fact there is a tree disease here in Oregon along the coast that likewise is impacted. If you look at the lodgepole pine and look what's happening across Canada, this is because the winters aren't cold enough to keep the insect sequestered that happens to move a plant pathogen that kills the trees. So it's...
And that's it's a very serious issue, and we're actually spending state dollars to help.
And I am extremely grateful to see the recognition that the water issue is going to be a very limiting issue for us.
Well, if I may just add one further comment. You've just given us another tool to use to illustrate how serious the global warming issue is, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we're going to hear about the public health impacts from Gail Shibley, who's the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And I'll be right back. So my vice chair is going to start you off.
If anyone wants copies of this water publication, send your card, send me an email, and I'd be happy to get access to the
For the record, my name is Gail Shibley. I'm the administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health for the State of Oregon. It is a pleasure to be here. Let me see if I can get out of this. You know, I'm talking to a Macophile here. Okay.
There you go.
Is this it? No.
The lower US.
Okay.
to move the folders here.
So I wanted to just take a couple minutes here to share with you some information on one high-value species here in this ecosystem, human beings. There are about 3.5 million of us in the state of Oregon, quickly moving to 4.5 million. And climate change affects us from a human health standpoint as well. Pardon me for my technical difficulties here.
Oh, now it's coming up. There it is.
Bless you. I'll go to F, maybe.
Yeah, there you go.
There we go. Oops, I went too far. The shrink. Sorry.
Gail, be careful with the big one.
Find a magnifier. Here we go.
Yeah, I've
gone
to my computer.
I did not make photocopies of an article that is literally just out in the American Journal of Public Health. Dr. Howie Frumpkin and some of his colleagues at the University of, at US EPA. Do you need this? Okay. Sorry. It's nice to have friends. Thank you very much. I've just come out with an article called Climate Change, the Public Health Response. And we in public health are looking at many of the same issues and concerns that have been raised here today, and I don't need to go over them. The reality is that when we're talking about heat waves, severe weather, sea level changes, groundwater changes, vector-borne disease, food and waterborne disease, air pollution, changes in physical activity, the kind of population displacement. We've talked already about some of the species displacement and ecosystem stresses. All of those affect very immediately public health. Okay. Bless you. And no, I am not Melvin Cohn. He's actually at his daughter's bat mitzvah today, so you get me. I apologize, but this is something that Mel and I have been working on together, and with our colleagues in other executive branch agencies, and with some local health departments as well. We do have a growing obesity problem. No, this is sorry. Okay.
I noticed you said that just to
As I mentioned, we're looking at a lot of the same data that you all have seen. When we're talking about flood events by continent, by decade, we recognize, of course, that just as all politics is local, all public health is local as well, and so what's going on in Oceania may or may not have a direct impact on us, but it certainly is indicative of things that are going on a global scale, and when we're looking at flood events, for example, you have turbidity in some of the flood runoff that I think it was Dr. Nielsen or others were talking about earlier. Increased turbidity, of course, is actually a vector for toxic chemicals. And so you can't have increased turbidity without some increase in or decrease in the water quality, quite apart from just the suspended sediment issue as well. So as we're looking here in Oregon, our colleagues at Dogami have really done and are doing some terrific work with other colleagues as well, just looking at what are some of the impacts potentially from an environmental standpoint. What we try to do then is take that the next step further and say, what does that mean for the people who are living there, who are working there, visiting, etc. And it's sobering, to say the least. I say that particularly because most of the population in the state of Oregon relies on surface water for their drinking water. And as I said, when you've got floods and then droughts and floods and droughts and these kinds of extreme weather conditions, you have some just inherent vulnerabilities with surface water. And I see the city of Portland is here, so she'll say that she's taking care of things perfectly well, and actually Portland is. The other reality, and I know some folks have heard me say this before, that most of the thousands of public drinking water systems in the state rely on groundwater, and there are additional challenges and hurdles, again, when you talk about the water quantity affecting the water quality. So we're looking at that. Then switching from water to fire, again, we're looking at what's going on here on this continent compared to other continents around the globe, and it's pretty sobering. In addition to, just the whatever the impact may be on the specific vegetation, we know that PM10 and particulate matter 2.5, whatever size particulate matter the different heat different temperatures and heat that is generated from wildfires impacts human respiratory systems. We're certainly not the only ones that are so affected, but I'm trying to particularly highlight something that may or may not get the most attention as we talk about global climate change. We already have asthma rates at a particularly high level. That rate is increasing and is expected to increase even more. We see data like these, and it sobers us up very quickly as well. So what does it mean specifically for human health? As my colleagues have shared, in fact, I want to just read you something. Why do we care about it? Well, public health, this is actually from one of the ethical practice of public health. I'll quote, public health should address principally the fundamental causes of disease and requirements for health, aiming to prevent adverse health outcomes. That's kind of the Hippocratic Oath for public health. And nothing can be more fundamental than what is going on at a global scale in terms of our changing climate and the impact that it might have. Most of what we can do within the public health sphere in terms of working on this and trying to provide both information and some policy options is to really focus on adaptation issues. Certainly mitigation and prevention, very, very key, but from a public health standpoint, adaptation efforts really correspond very, very closely to conventional medical and public health practices. What we're really talking about is preparedness. And so what we are looking at are we actually have first of all, we are doing some good things here in Oregon. We're working with our colleagues in the executive branch as well as OSU, U of O, Portland State, and others. The fact is, we're not there. We don't have the resources, and we are not as prepared as we need to be in order to prevent the kind of disease and death and disability and suffering that very closely to conventional medical and public health practices. What we're really talking about is preparedness. And so what we're what we are looking at are, we actually have, first of all, we are doing some good things here in Oregon. We're working with our colleagues in the executive branch, as well as OSU, U of O, Portland State, and others. The fact is, we're not there. We don't have the resources, and we are not as prepared as we need to be in order to prevent the kind of disease and death and disability and suffering that we think very much could occur here. We do have, at this point, in play a modest budget proposal that would, for the first time in the history of the state of Oregon, provide some specific public health expertise to state, capital S, statewide climate change integration efforts to deal with public health planning, toxicology, as well as risk communication to go with the risk assessment, to really complement and integrate with all of the mitigation and prevention efforts that are going on with the Department of Energy and DEQ and others. So the adaptation pieces really are around taking the modeling, the forecasting, and doing the planning, providing technical assistance and risk communication. It really, again, is preparedness. We did get 1 year of some federal dollars to do some drinking water preparedness. That's great. We are several years behind, and we have a lot more work to do. That money went away after 1 year, and so we're struggling to try to figure out just how we can continue to move forward. We've got about 3,600 public water systems in the state that need and deserve to have that kind of technical assistance. But we also think that there's a terrific opportunity to move, in addition to owning, if you will, some big pieces around climate change adaptation, to play a very important role around mitigation. Specifically, and I'm sorry, Senator Morissette, he would be smiling if he could hear me say this, health impact assessments, which is something that has expressed real interest in, which is taking a look at when you build something, when you design something, when you develop something, to recognize and to analyze and evaluate the human health impact of what you're doing, so that you design it in a way that, on the one hand, you don't, you want to make something very safe in terms of building code and design from a fire standpoint. That's very important and very appropriate. At the same time, then you hide away the stairs and you don't let them be anywhere out in the open, and so everybody takes the elevator, and consequently you design things in a way that kind of is disconnected from physical activity and a more active lifestyle. So, and that's just perhaps a small example of what I'm talking about in terms of really looking at how we design something and how we design a whole series of things, as in communities and parks and other broader scale built environment. Really looking at land use transportation choices to get at the air quality and the water quality. The good news, or the bad news, is that all of this is interconnected. When we talk about obesity and diabetes and heart disease and asthma, respiratory disease, etc., the good news is this is all interconnected. And so working together with them, no one entity, no one agency owns either the authority or the responsibility, so it really does take all of us providing our particular expert niche into this. And that's where public health fits in. I'll close by just saying that I just literally got back the other day from meeting with my colleagues around the country, the state environmental health directors, and I have been tasked to participate on a small work group there together with NCSL, the National Conference for State Legislatures. We want to and are committed to putting together a model public health climate change program. And so you'll be hearing perhaps more about that as we move forward.
Great. Thank you so much, Gail. Any quick questions for Gail? I know we have a few members that need to leave. Okay, thank you so much for coming today, and appreciate the members who could join us. And certainly hope to see you at future meetings.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Glad we have the Eugene Provelis contingent well represented here. Okay, next, and last but not least, we have Gail Achterman, the director of the Institute of Natural Resources. And just to note, we'll have Dean Abbott follow up, and both of you have 12 minutes together, so I know that you can be brief.
I'll be very brief. Gail Achterman, director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University and chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission, and I'm here with essentially both hats on, and would like to talk to you very briefly about three things. What's the effect of climate transportation on climate change? What's that connection? What is the Oregon Transportation Department doing to address those impacts? And what is the role of the university in, or the university system in directing those impacts? And I think the first thing I'd like to point out to you in the very beginning of the testimony is really there are four critical concepts associated with the effect of transportation on climate. And it's important to think about all four of those because you as legislators are going to be receiving various proposals in the governor's 2009 initiative on transportation that will hopefully address all of these things. I think it's a very important framework. And when you recognize that 34% of greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon are attributable to the transportation sector, we've got to really focus and focus hard on how to reduce emissions from the transportation sector if we have any hope of meeting the goal that you as a legislative body have set. And the four ways to really achieve these reductions are switching our fleets to use of low carbon fuels, whether that is biofuels, electricity, hydrogen fuel cells. We've got to switch fuels. That's number one. These are not in priority order. We have to do all of them. Second, we've got to use cleaner, more efficient vehicles. And this is a particular opportunity in the trucking sector, which is a big part of these greenhouse gas emissions, and it involves both powertrain improvements and non-engine improvements in terms of streamlining so that you get much more efficient vehicles, whether you're talking cars or trucks. And many of these, particularly in the trucking sector, are very cost effective. They pay for themselves very rapidly. The third area is reduction in vehicle miles traveled, and this is probably the most challenging of the four, because even if we got all the reductions we can conceive of in terms of lower carbon fuels and cleaner, more efficient vehicles, our vehicle mile travels are traveled are growing faster than our population, and so we have to reduce VMTs, and this means shifting to other modes that have less impact, and it means implementing not only mode switching, but demand management, and that's going to require things like congestion pricing. I doubt, frankly, that Oregon will ever be an appropriate place for cordon pricing, but who knows? And it will mean changes in our land use planning, and we're already having conversations with the Land Conservation and Development Commission and the Department of Environmental Quality to really think about what can we do from a land use standpoint, and also what can we do from an incentive standpoint to encourage practices that reduce VMTs and encourage fleet conversion both. And then the fourth thing is systems optimization. When you're stuck in a traffic jam, as I expect I'm going to be on my way back, as soon as I get north of Wilsonville tonight, I'll be in a traffic jam and I'll be moving very slowly. I have a Prius and it'll shut off. But when congestion happens, emissions go up. And so to the extent that we can reduce congestion by improving the operation of the existing system, we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And it's also a very, very cost-effective way, probably the most cost-effective way, to improve mobility for citizens. And this means doing things like figuring out how to get wrecks removed faster, doing traffic signal timing, and a whole variety of optimization strategies. So four strategies: fuel switching, more efficient vehicles, reduction in VMT, and systems optimization. the universities, and with my hat as a research institute director at OSU, we are extremely fortunate that Congressman DeFazio was able to get the funding for the Oregon Transportation Research and Education Consortium involving PSU, OSU, OIT, and the University of Oregon. Our educators, our scientists at the university not only are training the next generation of people who are going to help come up with these solutions, but they're actually doing really cutting-edge research in all of the areas that I talked about before that we need to be tackling. And I've just highlighted one example with Dr. Karen Dixon from the Civil Engineering Department here, who's looking on ways to improve the incident response times and incident management between Oregon State Police, the emergency management providers, and the local transportation agencies, so that we don't have Interstate 5 shut down for 6 hours because somebody had a wreck, which has happened. And it's horrible from a climate, from a greenhouse gas emission standpoint, and it's horrible from an economic and personal standpoint for anyone who gets stuck in it. I have provided you are the very first ones to get this. The hot off the presses, the Oregon Department of Transportation in its own operations is doing a number of things to address these climate change impacts, probably the most exciting of which is our Solar Highways Initiative, which I know Representative Beyer has had briefings on, where we're probably going to be the first state in the United States to have installation of solar arrays on our highway rights of way, so that ODOT as a department is going to be getting all of its energy from solar energy, we hope, within a fairly quick time period. So the 44 megawatts a year that we use as an agency will all be coming from renewable solar power generated on our rights of way, rather than buying less climate-friendly power. We are also providing key funding to groups like Cascade Sierra Solutions, which is really an outgrowth of the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority, where we are at the forefront of the West Coast effort on idle-free diesel technologies and deployment of those technologies throughout the West Coast. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. There is a much longer PowerPoint that at a minimum takes, I think I can do it in 15 minutes. We didn't have time for that today, but we'd be happy to go into any of this either with the department or with the university researchers at your leisure.
Great. Thank you so much, Gail. And also, if you could email a PowerPoint to Beth, she will make sure and send it out.
Beth, if you would you'll send me a reminder, I'll send you the email. Mm-hmm. And I'll probably send it in we'll worry about that.
Thank you. Any questions for you, Representative Beyer?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be real quick. I'm curious on the first paragraph and your numbers and how current those numbers might be.
The 34% of Oregon emissions, and Bill is here from the Oregon Department of Energy, and he's the most familiar with our latest inventory. But, Bill, that inventory was done like 2 months ago, I think, was when you wrapped it up.
Midsummer.
Well, a few months ago. They're quite recent. And the numbers on the breakdown between cars and trucks, and I have a graphic here that is in the PowerPoint presentation, the breakdown between cars, light trucks, and heavy trucks is 2002 EPA data.
Just a real follow-up. I'm curious because I know that there probably isn't anything that has impacted these numbers, you know, drastically. But between the cost of gas, the steps we're taking on emissions with trucks, could they have influenced these numbers at all at this point, or is this too early?
I think it's Chair Dingfelder, Representative Beyer. In my view, and Bill might disagree with me, I think it's too early. I don't think we've had anywhere near the penetration on the fleet to have those impacts show up yet. And the other thing that I think has been a surprise to all of us is that there really was projection that you would see the vehicle mile travel reductions at gas at $3 a gallon, and it didn't happen. So that price elasticity, and it has to do with a lot of the land use patterns. There are a lot of people who simply do not have a choice. And $3 a gallon was not enough to get them to switch. The experts indicate, and they are now saying, they think it's maybe closer to $5 a gallon to have a price signal switch on fuel. That said, in talking to local government officials around Oregon, particularly in rural communities, and I don't know the figures from TriMet, but and the other mass transit agencies, but I know from in rural counties they are seeing significant increases in the demand for their mass transit services. The county judge in Wallowa County, the people who work in the Joseph area can't afford to live there, and the shuttle bus service that they have from Enterprise in the lower valley to Joseph in the upper valley is now packed and they can't meet demand, and he attributes it to the cost of gas and the fact that the workers can't afford to drive their vehicles those extra miles up to Joseph. So anecdotally we're hearing that, but it's not showing in any of the data yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much.
And if I may, Madam Chair, that's the point at which we start seeing changes in land use planning driven by transportation costs.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you know Oregon is better off than most places in the country because of our 30 years of land use planning, the fact that we have urban growth boundaries, but certainly we can do better in many areas. But we are seeing that Oregon is being used as an example all over the country that has had a lot of sprawl, and it's actually going to be very challenging for many areas. We certainly can do better in funding public transportation and transit options, especially for rural communities. I think it's going to be really important. So finally, we have Dean Abbott, who's going to provide us with a very brief update.
No, 4:15. I've got 14 seconds.
Yes, you've got 14 seconds. Review of the final report of the Governor's Climate Change Integration Group. I want to make sure everybody has a copy. I think they're being handed out right now.
Everybody has
copies. And then there's been the first meeting.
Right.
And you'll give a summary on that. And then I know I have two people who want to provide public comment, and certainly we'll ask them. They can keep their remarks to 2 to 3 minutes, and then we'll try to convene by 4:30.
Thanks, Chairwoman.
We'll give you about 5 minutes.
Okay, good. 5 minutes on maybe a different planet that's rotating slower. So
yes.
You're all getting a copy of the report, and I've provided also an excerpt from the executive summary, so it's the super executive summary. It's just a few pages just to hit the highlights, and you will see most of the key recommendations. I think what you've heard today from the scientists here is that both the natural environment and the human environment have really adapted to what we will call the average conditions within their area, and they can handle a certain level of extremes and variability. What we're seeing is a planet that's changing much more rapidly and down paths that we can't expect. That's hard on ecosystems, that's hard on business, and that's hard on governments. You all know how hard it is to invest in a stock market that's going up and down several percent. You don't know whether to stay or sell or move, and you can see that in financial markets all the time. We're starting to see the same kinds of forcing on the natural ecosystem as well. So the Climate Change Integration Group recognized that and said we can't use the past to predict the future anymore. And in some sense, this is true for people and true for natural ecosystems. We just don't have the capacity in our institutions to plan and adapt to those kinds of systems. And we really have to look at fundamentally doing things in a different way. Gail Achterman pointed this out just in the transportation sector. We need to consider climate change as a key element in our planning and decision making. We need to modify our planning and decision making processes so that we look at everything holistically, so that we consider these interconnected systems. Impacts on land use changes have impacts on vehicle miles traveled. And this isn't just for mitigation, it's to prepare and adapt to a changing environment. And those processes also have to be much more dynamic. We have to make some changes, assess, and reevaluate. We can't just build stronger and bigger seawalls along the coast. We have to build in resilience so that when things fail, they fail relatively gracefully, and we can learn from that and go in and adapt and change how we do that. We think that kind of a proactive strategy to building a new framework for planning is not only going to make our environment and our economy stronger, there's also significant opportunity for Oregon to lead not only the nation but the world in how to do that kind of planning. So solar cell factories are important, but that integrated process, that new way of doing business, that new way of doing politics and planning is something that we can serve as a model to the nation and the world. Part of that, and I'll just drop into the Climate Change Research Institute. That was another element that was formed in House Bill 3543 last year. We have a steering committee that consists of faculty members from the University of Oregon, Portland State University, OSU, Southern Oregon, Oregon Institute of Technology, and Oregon Health and Science University. They put together a position description. The advertisement and position were just closed earlier this week, and I'm pleased to say we have some outstanding scientists from around the, actually international, there was one person from Europe even who applied, but around the country there's some top-notch people. The committee is going to have a hard job. I'm glad I'm not on it. They're going to probably invite 3 to 4 people to Oregon who will visit Corvallis, Salem, and Portland and meet with people in both the Oregon University system as well as with state government agencies and other appropriate and interested individuals in that process. Since it's after 4 on Friday, I can make one academic story. I'm an administrator, but I do like to tell you one thing on science. There have been 2 grand planetary experiments that have been conducted in the last 4 billion years. The first was the creation of life, which was a really interesting interplay between climate, plate tectonics, and geochemistry, and all of the machinery that forms life, photosynthesis, using energy, were all created several billion years ago, and one can look at evolution as really just sort of a rearrangement of the pieces. That system has been tuned and really in place for many billion years. The last 250 years, our activity has sped up the carbon cycle a millionfold. And so that's the great experiment that we're living in, and we get to prepare and adapt and learn from it. So with that, be happy to answer a few questions.
Thank you, David. And I have read the report that you hand out, and certainly encourage my colleagues to do that and then come back with any questions, because we certainly will have, you know, coming back and providing updates on a regular basis to our committee. Any quick questions? Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Abbott, quickly on the Institute, what was your budget request? What did you get? And where?
The budget request was much bigger. It came in at $180,000 beginning July 1 of this year, then with a roll-up next year of $360,000 per biennium. That's
an additional or just $360,000 for the next biennium?
In total for the next biennium, 360.
2 years instead of 1 year.
2 years instead of 1 year.
I have to do the math. I just wanted to make sure.
That's why we have the revenue committee here.
Okay, but you didn't get the 180 this year, did you?
It will be this July 1, this coming July 1. So the second half of the biennium, we will get the 180.
So you're not having to dip into any existing?
No.
Okay, thank you.
But you didn't get what you originally.
The original request was more like 800,000.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
We are well aware that you didn't get the original request.
No one ever does.
We look forward to working with you.
Thank you very much.
Apologize about the rush.
No problem.
And I will, even though this is an informational hearing, we wanted to provide some time for public comment because we had several folks that wanted to provide some information. Lorna Stickle, I know, is here from the City of Portland. I want to come up and say a few words. I also know that Thousand Friends want to present a letter, and if there's anybody else on deck, you'll have about 2 to 3 minutes. I know Lorna can talk very quickly.
Yeah, I can. Okay. I'm going to run on here.
And for the record, please.
Yeah, Lorna Stickle, Water Resources Program Manager for the Portland Water Bureau and also Program Manager for the Regional Water Providers Consortium and Water Planner Extraordinaire, just so you know.
And for the Water Resources.
Sense of humor, I like it. Okay. What you have here is one letter that's just one page, and then some attachments. The municipal water providers in Oregon, of course, are very concerned about climate change, and and it's been on our radar screen. I actually was reading a report from the Water Bureau from 1986, where that was the first time that I'd actually seen a presentation of at least some expressing concern. But I'd say it's ramped up quite a bit in the last couple of years. And I think the fear is that because we've tended to use a historic record, probably going back about 60 years, if you're lucky, you've got more than that, that's not a very representative period of time necessary to help us figure out what the worst has been in the last 60 years in terms of what it might be in the next 60 years. So seeing things outside the bound, even with some paleoclimate reconstructions helping us to grasp a little bit better about what past climate variability was, and you don't have to go back very far to see 1840 was a significantly worse drought than anything we've seen in our 60-year record that we have. So we are concerned about it, and we are participating, many of us, in national forums to try and get a better handle on this. We submitted the Regional Water Providers Consortium, which makes up about 90% of the water providers in the Portland metropolitan area, submitted a list of questions when the legislature was considering the Climate Institute, and I've attached the set of questions that we provided as a part of that, I don't think any of these have changed particularly much. They're still good questions and things that we would like to form a more collaborative working relationship with the academic community to help us understand these issues better. In addition to that, the federal government is ramping up considerably also on this subject. And there's a climate change science program that's an umbrella over about 13 different federal agencies that all have a role to play or manage some programs that are impacted by climate change. And they've been revising their strategy, which hasn't been since 2003. And the subsequent two documents are some very specific comments that we've provided to the federal government on this strategy by a set of water entities that Portland recently joined. There's eight of us around the country. We're all the largest metropolitan water providers, or many of the larger ones, that have formed a water utility Climate Alliance, specifically to try and grasp a better handle on this subject. And so that's what the rest of this information is about. So with that, I'm done.
Great. Thank you, Lorna. Any questions for Lorna? Appreciate your input. Okay. Next up is Executive Director of Thousand Friends. I guess in an entourage, and you're speaking for all of them, right, Bob?
Well, we'll all speak very quickly. Each
we'll have a minute each.
Very good.
If you divide it up.
Madam Chairman of the Committee, my name is Bob Stacey from Thousand Friends of Oregon. With me are Jeremiah Bauman from Environment Oregon and Sally Schillinger Kraus from Oregon Environmental Council. Our three organizations recently submitted a letter to three state commissions addressing the relationship between global warming, transportation, and land use planning. Our three groups, my two colleagues' groups, More Than 1,000 Friends, have been working long on climate change. We also have been invited by the governor to serve on the Transportation Vision Task Force. Our goal is to identify a way in which our state's need for transportation investment can be integrated with our state's need to meet our climate change goals. Sally will go first with her minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
You state your name for the record, please.
Sally Schillinger Kraus with the Oregon Environmental Council. And I was going to talk actually about the four-legged stool of carbon reduction from transportation, but Gail Ackerman has done a very good job of summing that up, so I won't reiterate it. Basically, if you're looking at clean cars, cleaner fuels, reductions in VMT, and system management and optimization, Oregon has already made a couple of strides in addressing two of those legs, cleaner cars and cleaner fuels through the biofuels standard passage of last year and also through the adoption of clean car standards. That being said, clean car standards are in danger of being delayed due to EPA's refusal to grant California the waiver it needs. So the thing that we really need to now look
invited by the governor to serve on the Transportation Vision Task Force. Our goal is to identify a way in which our state's need for transportation investment can be integrated with our state's need to meet our climate change goals. Sally will go first with her minute.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
State your name for the record, please.
Sally Schillinger-Krass with the Oregon Environmental Council. And I was going to talk actually about the four-legged stool of carbon reduction from transportation, but Gail Ackerman has done a very good job of summing that up, so I won't reiterate it. Basically, if you're looking at clean cars, cleaner fuels, reductions in VMT and system management and optimization, Oregon has already made a couple of strides in addressing two of those legs, cleaner cars and cleaner fuels through the biofuels standard passage of last year and also through the adoption of clean car standards. That being said, clean car standards are in danger of being delayed due to EPA's refusal to grant California the waiver it needs. So the thing that we really need to now look at are our VMT reductions and the system optimization. And for those purposes, it's really critical that the Department of Transportation and Land Use and the Land Use agencies are really moving forward to incorporate climate change planning within their overall planning structure and programs. So with that, I will pass it over to Jeremiah, who will give some examples of the things that they can do.
Great. And I also want to mention we did pass the clean diesel program last session, which helps with retrofitting existing trucks.
Can I ask a question just so Jeremiah can't come up here?
No. I think you should ask it of Jeremiah.
I have to wait for me to ask even a hard question.
For the record.
The record, Jeremiah Bauman with Environment Oregon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, very briefly, I just want to make 3 points. One is people have talked about sort of the combination of strategies that have to be used to meet our carbon reduction goals. Our national organization did a study looking at what it would take nationally for the whole United States to do a 20% reduction in global warming pollution by 2020. And I just want to give that out as an example because it's helpful to, I think, put some numbers on how these strategies relate to each other. What it resulted in is that if on the electricity side, you met a 20% renewable energy requirement by 2020, which is consistent with Oregon's, and you used energy conservation to reduce electricity consumption 10% from current levels. That covers the electricity side. And on the transportation side, if you get a 10% reduction in the carbon content of the fuels through biofuels, through transitions to electric vehicles, etc., if you get gas mileage to 40 miles per gallon by 2020, which is not very far off from where current increases are headed. And under that scenario, what you would need to do in terms of vehicle travel and vehicle miles traveled is stabilize at current levels, presumably under a curve that would go up for a while and then stabilize back down. That would be the final wedge that would get you to that carbon reduction goal, which I actually found very, it led me to be more optimistic. It doesn't require a significant, you don't need to get all Oregonians out of their cars or something. We basically need to decrease per capita vehicle miles traveled as population increases so that we stay at roughly the total vehicle miles traveled that we've got today. Second point, I just wanted to emphasize the role of land use here. We need to, I think, even better integrate land use planning with transportation planning because especially in rural communities, the same transit options just won't work with the current land use patterns. And going along with that, I think our plan for dealing with land use and transportation sector solutions to global warming has to have a lot of flexibility in it. The reality is that current compact development in the Portland area is going to mean we can move on transit much more rapidly in that area than we can in a lot of other parts of the state. It also means that certain types of transit are just going to work better in rural areas. It might just mean more shuttle buses in a place like Wallowa County, not some crazy plan for, you know, connecting light rail between every community in the state. Well, that wouldn't be fun. The last point I'll just make, because I don't think I've heard it up here today, is that in the Western Climate Initiative and other conversations where a cap and trade program is being developed for global warming pollution, we are advocating strongly that transportation sector actually be included there and that transportation fuels distributors be part of that cap and trade program, which not only starts us on a plan towards reducing global warming pollution in those sectors, but assuming that the carbon permits are auctioned to run a windfall when companies can buy and sell permits that they were given at a public value. Those auction revenues would be a new revenue source to use for transportation investments that would help us meet our global warming pollution reduction goals. That's all I've got.
Thank you. Any questions for Jeremiah that he can answer for everyone?
Simply a quick comment. I'm really pleased to see that you're helping me take care of my job. And that's exactly what I was hoping that you were going to say. The last three sentences.
Go ahead,
the economic component. Representative Burley.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. Jeremiah, I appreciate your recognizing rural communities. And, you know, as I've heard this discussion starting with Gail and others about the land use and how we integrate that in transportation, we do have two entirely different systems here. And, you know, those of us that have to travel several hundred miles in a day just to do our job have a different set of scenarios than those that live in a more urban environment. And so I'm not sure what the answer is, but I appreciate the cognizance of that issue.
Any other questions or comments?
I was just following up on that point, highlighting one statement in this letter that greater reductions in VMT should be expected from the six metropolitan areas than from the balance of the state, and go on to explain why. But I think that kind of sensitivity to the diversity of the state and diversity of its needs is going to be really important as we move forward on this. So thank you.
Good point. Thank you, Representative Cannon. Is there anybody else who would like to come up and make comment? Okay, sir, and just please make sure and identify yourself for the record. And I will, again, we're limiting to 2 to 3 minutes, please.
You want to go back to me that one?
Yes, yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Frank Holmes with Western States Petroleum Association. I'm sorry that the WCI portion of the program had to be removed, but I'm glad to see that you're going to be looking at what the WCI is doing.
And we'll have an update at the next hearing as well.
Right. Just a couple of things, and again, very quickly, from the petroleum industry perspective, and I know that our friends here just said the opposite of what I'm going to say, but
what the process is all about.
Yeah, from including the transportation fuels in a cap and trade program, and we do support a cap and trade program, and market mechanisms is the most cost-effective way to get greenhouse gas reductions. But including transportation fuels and possibly not including offsets is a way to significantly increase the cost of a program. We're looking at the minimum cost-effectiveness of reaching our objectives, and including transportation fuels is not the way to make that happen. So there are other ways to address the transportation issue, but not in the cap and trade program. And secondly, part of the WCI process is doing an economic analysis of the impacts of the various options of the program. We support that very much and think it should go forward. But part of that economic analysis is not looking at energy supply and the following macroeconomic fallout from potential changes in that. And we strongly feel that this needs to be included, whether at an Oregon level after that program was completed or some other fashion to get that economic analysis, including in any decision makings that go forward. This really needs to happen. And then finally, as far as the broad use of auctions and or mitigation fees, we want to minimize those because those, in effect, are really taxes. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much for your comments. Please come up and identify yourself for the record.
I'm Charlie Tomlinson, Mayor of the City of Corvallis.
Welcome. Thank you for our city.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you here today, and I want to recognize Oregon University System's work, and especially Oregon State University in particular, and their ability to well position us to deal with our climate protection issues. I also want to note for the record that Oregon mayors representing a third of Oregonians had signed the U.S. Conference of Mayors Climate Protection Agreement. This agreement is consistent with state climate protection efforts and indicates a growing recognition in Oregon that this is a very important issue. My main points this afternoon are, as the legislature and the governor's office develops the climate protection agenda, especially in the 09 legislative session, please keep local government engaged, either through the League of Oregon Cities or representatives of local municipalities. Corvallis is working on our vision for a sustainable community and would like to work with the state in this endeavor. Second point is the Department of Environmental Quality greenhouse gas reporting protocols and administrative rules, which are out for review and will be here in Corvallis later in the month. I will testify, and I would note today that they should somehow enable cities to determine their part of the total Oregon greenhouse gas emission profile, so that once DEQ knows what the entire state of Oregon looks like, we should be able to tell the city of Corvallis, this is your piece of it. Because we need to know where we are and how we're doing on our remediation efforts around the lower greenhouse gases, and it seems to me that integration of the protocol at the city level would be very beneficial for us. And the third thing I'd like to note is that Oregon wastewater treatment plants utilize 5% of the electricity consumed in our state. 5%. State and local government collaboration to make these operations carbon neutral would greatly benefit our citizens and help us meet our greenhouse gas reduction targets. We in Corvallis are working with the Energy Trust of Oregon to begin to move our wastewater treatment facility to a carbon neutral state, but I think that it might be an area to focus on in the future as we try to lower that 42% of greenhouse gas emissions that come from electricity. Thank you very much for your service.
Thank you, Mayor. Really appreciate your input, and we look forward to working with you, and these are excellent suggestions.
Thank you.
Anybody else would like to make some comments? Okay, with that, colleagues, I just want to remind you our next hearing is in Salem on May 29th. We're going to have a joint hearing with the Revenue Committee.
Thursday,
May 29th, and we will be hearing a lot more on climate change. The focus is on basically what are the tools available for reducing greenhouse gases and addressing climate change. So stay tuned for the agenda. It'll be posted soon. Again, I want to thank the university, thank the mayor of Corvallis for having us here today, and look forward to seeing folks on the 29th. And I will close the informational hearing, the House Energy and Environment. On basically what are the tools available for reducing greenhouse gases and addressing climate change. So stay tuned for the agenda. It'll be posted soon. Again, I want to thank the university, thank the mayor of Corvallis for having us here today, and look forward to seeing folks on the 29th. And I will close the informational hearing, the House Energy and Environment.